So then when I'm jumping over a number of years, my father, first he had a tea shop, a restaurant, as we call it, where they serve tea and biscuits and cake. You know, the Iranis were the only ones in that era who had tea shops. They were the best and the only. You never heard of a Hindu tea shop or any other tea shop. I mean, this was their trade, as it turned out to be like that. Like my uncles had. I mean, many Iranis that we know of had. So then later there was the toddy shop. And, but my father wasn't practical in the sense of money and things like that. For instance, sometimes he had to stay over the nights at the toddy shop. So my mother would give him a blanket, so that it was cold weather and he would be comfortable. Invariably, he came back home without the blanket. And the moment mother would say, Cheryl, but Shirin, she was so poor. Shirin, he was very cold. You know, it always given it away. So my mother had to be practical. She was, naturally. And, for instance, I still remember the figure. There were 42 employees at the toddy shops. And they all came home to get their salaries from mother. Mother couldn't trust father with the money. He would have given it all away, probably, and said he was so poor or she was starving. And I also have heard from someone who saw Baba when this person was a little boy, and he said, I would stand before the toddy shop and see Mehrwanji in the shop. He was later a taxi driver whom I met. So I asked him, I said, and what was Mehrwanji doing in the shop? Where was he seated? He said, he was seated right behind the cash box. I said, oh, yes, yes. And I would stand by and look at him. And then all the fakirs would come in the afternoons. You know, the mendicants, but the fakirs are different. The Muslim ones who don't actually beg. But they receive alms, they sing, and in out of respect, everyone knows this is a fakir and you give something in their bowl. So all the fakirs would gather. And then Mehrwanji would open the cash box and put his whole hand in it and bring out fists of coins, silver coins, rupees, 8 annas in those days were real silver, and fling it out. And all the fakirs would go and pick them up, scramble, you know, and pick them up. And I said to myself, my poor mother, with a dervish for a husband and a son for God for a son. I mean, she had to be practical. So whenever my father came back without the blanket, I didn't know how many times it had happened until one day I found my mother burst out and say, but Sherlock, she said, if I had kept all the blankets that I've given you all these years, I could have started a blanket shop and made, you know, raised my children on that. So things like that. And my father, at this time, the story that I want to tell you is that as time went on, my father took on an Irani boy who needed work. He was bright and he really desperately wanted a job, and my father kept him in the toddy shop to help him. Little by little, he picked up the reins, how to do this and how to do that. And my father was giving him more and more responsibility and things to do. There would be auctions, you see. There would be auctions of toddy trees. There would be acres of toddy trees that you bought in auction for the season to get the sap from the toddy trees to make the toddy. So my father would go, and that was during the British rule, you see. And so the auctioneer and all the others were sahibs, English people. So whenever my father, an old man now, he would be among those who would be bidding. The first bid he would make, very gently, he would say whatever he could give. The Englishman would bring down his hammer, you know, so, gone. And then I heard that the others then went and said, what is this? What is it? We were going to bid higher. Why do you bring the hammer down every time this old man says a sum? That was one of the things I heard as a child. It delighted me. So then this boy, this Irani boy that father...
My grandfather and Baba ne joya.
I don't
know. Golkunna.
Ose. Golem dinnos ose. Ha. Yes. But the other grandfather I don't know. What was I saying?
Tari action.
Yeah. So my father, little by little, found the Irani boy so helpful, and he was getting on in years, so he pushed more and more responsibility on the boy till he was practically a partner. I'm not sure whether he was legally a partner, but he was for all purposes a partner. And he would go to the auctions, he would do these things, but of course he needed my father's signature. He needed my father's authority for anything big like that. So one day he invited my father home, and my father went. There was a good meal, an Irani meal. My father enjoyed it. It was very congenial, and the father talked about Iran, and there was jokes, and very nice evening. My father was accompanied by one man from the shop who was devoted to Baba Lit. I mean, he is a Baba lover. So he was there with him. Nobody was there with the young man. So after it was all over and my father was about to leave, the young man suddenly called him back and said, "Oh, Sheriaji, I need your signature on this paper." And he talked about auction of the trees or something. So my father said, "Ah, yes, yes." He turned back and he took the pen the young man gave him and he said, "Sign here." And the rest of the page was covered, either by a blotter or some other paper. But my father didn't ask. He just signed his name to that document. It turned out that father signed a paper which said, "I give lock, stock and barrel of everything of the business to this young man. I give it over to him. It is all his." Now, I don't know the sequence, but I do know that the thing had to go to court. Now, here too, my mother was the one who would see to it all. My mother was the practical kind who would never put a signature to anything until she had read the whole thing or had it read or not. Very practical. My father, as I said, was there. So it went to court. And my mother would run to the lawyers, and the lawyer would come home, but then my mother would take what the lawyer gave and take it to a friend who was very educated, and ask him if it was all right for her to put her signature on behalf of Shoro or what, things like that. So then it turned out, I heard the lawyer tell my mother one day, "Shirinbai, please tell your husband, in court, he's taking the side of the opponent. You know, tell him, if he cannot say anything bad about him, tell him that please not say anything." And my mother would then tell Shoro. But Sharuk would say, "Shirin, I feel so sorry for that young man. You don't know what he will have to suffer. It's so much he will have to do. I feel, Sharuk, don't you feel sorry for me? Do you realize that our whole business and everything that is we have will be just wiped out? If you can't talk anything bad about him, at least keep mum. But don't praise the man. I mean, don't talk good about him in the court." "Yes, Shirin. No, Shirin. I'll remember that." And I remember when one day when he had to go to court, I remember the scene. This must have happened a number of times, but I was there and I remember it like it's a picture before me. A horse carriage, Tonga, had come to the door. My father was to sit in it and go to the court, you know, for evidence. We had that one man who gave evidence at what happened. He brought up about 100 false witnesses, the other one, you see. So this was getting difficult. But my father would not have anybody giving a false witness. And he said, no, it is perfectly true. I signed. It's my fault. I shouldn't have signed. I should have asked him to read out what's in there. So he didn't help any of the lawyers or the judges or anything. So here's the Tonga that comes to the door, and my father is seated in it, you know, white starched Parsi coat and pants on, and mother is near the Tonga and said, "Now, Sharuk, remember, Remember, don't take the side of that wretch, that rascal. Don't take a side. Now, if you can't say anything bad, keep mum. Yeah. And he was saying, yes, Shireen. And all the time, the little tongue was saying, yes, Dan, yes, Dan, yes, Dan. And, yes, Shireen. And Cheryl, don't let snuff spill on your white coat because it is all white and starched. No, Shireen. And she would say something more, yes, Shireen. And as he was saying this, and she was following it up, the tonga was moving away, and the horse was going on, and that he went to court. So that's one of the visits that I remember very clearly. So whenever I would come home in the afternoon from school, very often I would find that my plate was on the table, the food was on the warm on the by the fire, and a note was there. You know, I'm away, money. This is that. Take this, take that. Put this by, and all that. And so I would do it because mother was away, either to the friend or the lawyer, something to do with the court. She alone did it, the whole thing. And one day when I came home, I saw that the umbrella was in place. Every time she went out, she took this umbrella, which had a silver handle that looked like a horn, you know, the musical instrument that goes round like jellyby. And so it never was there. But one day when I came home, I saw the umbrella was on its hook, and I knew Mother was home. And when I went in, I found it was very quiet, too quiet. There was a stillness about it. And I was told, we have lost. We have lost the case. But there was no explosion. It was absolute, as if my mother had either resigned or was shocked. Anyway, there was nothing. And I heard her tell my father later in the afternoon, Cheryl, do you realize we have lost? And my father said, lost, Shireen? What can we lose? We have won long ago. We have already won. He meant in the real sense. We have won what is to be won. What is there to lose? So anyway, this was the thing. Now my father wrote a note to that young man because he had everything. We didn't appeal, didn't go into fight, no. So he wrote a note to the young man and said, I'm an old man. I haven't long in this world. I won't be very long in this world. But I want you to know that I have forgiven you. That I owe you nothing. And that sentence has caused me again and again to think that forgiveness is also something you must not keep because you owe it. It's not yours, you see. Only God can forgive. Forgiveness is God's. It is not yours. You cannot say, I will not forgive and I will keep that. No. You owe it. You may have to do it in the next life. So my father's words, I have forgiven you. I owe you nothing. Now it is up to you to ask. You are a young man. You have your whole life before you. It is up to you to ask forgiveness of God. On my part, I have forgiven. So that was that. We lost everything in the worldly sense. The business was all gone. Whatever was in the bank that mother had saved was paid for the lawyers and the court fees. I had heard also my mother saying this at some time, saying the judge said before everybody, pointing to the young man, he said, I know he's a rascal, but I'm helpless. The old man won't help me. So that was them. So whatever was in the bank was also gone. It was like a clean slate. And it was, as I've seen it again and again, those who are very close, very, very close, Baba accepts or takes what is apparently theirs, and then, either from that, or from his own, gives from him. So after all that was done, it was Baba who would send a certain amount each month. Not much, because Baba didn't have much at that time, financially, I mean. And that is how it went on. Now, after that, a year after that, When I say a year or any time, it means about. My father died.
Within a year?
Yes, just about within a year. My father died, and soon after that, I came to Baba for good. So this was all forgotten. Years later, when I asked Mother when she would come to Baba, she would always come for a month, 2 months, few days. And she said, oh, they're flourishing. You see, she watched the bay tree flourish. After they had taken everything from my father materially, they flourished. They had another story built to their house. Their tea shop was just expanding. They had more horse carriages. They were just flourishing. And it isn't as if my mother could leave and go to another town or a city. She had to be right there and watch. It hurt her. She was not beyond that. I mean, she would feel, she would see this. And acha. So anyway, what happened was, Mother died years later, and I think I was about 42, I think. I'm not absolutely sure. And then in 19 late 40s, we had come to Guru Prasad. I think it was our first time stepping into Guru Prasad. And Baba was giving darshan to his lovers, all from Pune, and whoever had heard were coming, on the veranda of Guru Prasad, that spacious marble veranda. So Baba had his chair outside, he was seated, and the lines of his lovers all coming through, winding like streams all the time through the gates and into the garden and up to him and bowing down at his feet and leaving. The whole veranda was full of them. They were sitting on those balustrades. The steps were full. All the lovers had come. But we were inside. We women were inside the house, the room, that big hall had those beautiful glass doors. So whatever we were doing, we would come now and then and peek through the glass and see Baba. The door was a little open also. We could hear and we could see. We would see just to look at Baba and go back. So once it so happened that I'd just come to the door and I looked out to see Baba, and I saw an old lady, obviously, definitely an Irani old lady, walk up the steps, those big marble steps of Guru Prasad, laboriously but steadily. And she came, and as she came, I looked at her and I said, she's so familiar. I've seen her before. Who is she? That I couldn't recollect. She came and she stood before Baba with no expression on her face. She just looked at him, and suddenly she fell on her knees. And I thought she was now going to bow down, but no, her head was bowed and her shoulders were shaking. She was crying. She was sobbing. So her head was over Baba's knees, lap. Baba took her head and guided it to his lap. I mean, pushed it down, pushed her head down onto his lap. And she sobbed, and she sobbed. Then he took his hand away, the sobbing was over, and she looked up. And Baba said, what is this? What is this? And she said, Baba, he won't die. He can't die. Life won't leave his body. He is ready to die. He's dying, but he won't die. He says, I must have forgiveness of God before I die. And he sent me to you. You must forgive him. And it all came back. I said, my God. This is Mulog's wife, so handsome, so active, such a bold personality, no? And very dashing. And here's this old, bent woman coming, and the husband, he'd been on bed for months, and it was as if his last moment had come. But she said, he's hanging on. He must have your forgiveness. They had never accepted Baba as God. They were, as I would remember, as on the other camp, you know. And here she was. So we hadn't told Baba all these things that had, you know, not outwardly we hadn't told, Baba had not been told. So when she said, he can't die, he won't die, he said, I must have forgiveness of God. You have to forgive him. Baba just looked in the distance. He was absolutely silent. I mean silent of movement. And looked. And then he nodded his head. And then he looked at her and said, all right, I forgive. And that gesture of Baba, that gesture of forgiving, is like a big wave from the ocean that comes onto the beach. And when it retreats, there is not a mark on the beach, not a trace, clear and clean. And Baba forgave. And I knew, because I knew the story, I said, this is, I watched this, witnessed this. And then she got up. Again, she just looked at him without an expression on her face, turned and walked down those steps. We never saw her again. Within a little over 24 hours later, he died. And I said to myself, yes, Father used to say he's a smart boy. He really was. He remembered Father's note, you must ask forgiveness of God. So at the end, and he got that too.